Welcome to the Tabletop Submarine, where we dive a little bit deeper into why we love board games. Strap in and prepare for a deep sea adventure. Here are your hosts.
Hey, Andrew.
Yes?
I recently watched this documentary about a gentleman who was an author, and he goes around with his girlfriend in a minibus, and she is an audiophile herself, and they go around and they listen to music. She especially likes the 70s stuff that's on like records, and they ride around America listening to music, and he does his books and stuff. Does that sound pretty cool?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, documentary is called The Van Rider and His Vinyl Girl.
Okay.
Wow.
You really got me at that one. Yep, you got me there. I did not see it coming.
Listeners, welcome to the Tabletop Submarine Podcast. It is so good to have you here with us. As always, my name is Josh, your loyal pun deliverer and sea captain. With me is my number one co-host.
Yeah, I'm the victim here, but yes, I'm number two. I'm Andrew, and today's guest is awesome. We're big fans. Special guest, Julie Ahern of Van Rider Games, also game designer, developer extraordinaire, tabletop RPG lover, and all sorts of things, cat mom stuff. So yeah, all sorts of awesomeness. Welcome to the show, Julie.
Thank you so much for having me.
So he just laid out your resume for you, but yeah. Julie, what might people know you from, or what do you do in the tabletop industry?
So I started in the tabletop industry as a writer. So I wrote a lot for Greenbrier Games. I'm one of the co-founders of that company. So I worked on Folklore the Affliction and designed Tales of Barbaria, co-designed The Apocalypse, and then came to work for Van Rider Games about a year and a half ago, and have worked on Final Girl and stuff like that. And then I also am on a podcast now with Aman at the Table with the Dice Tower, where I clearly spend most of the time telling Tom why he's wrong. So that's
a worthy spend of time. Yeah. Well done.
And I've done some other stuff, but yeah, I've worn most of the hats.
So it's a very impressive list of things you've done. Did you see yourself going into table? Did you have like a goal to go into tabletop industry and that's where you are today? Or did you kind of just stumble into it and that's where you are now?
I've always played games, designed games. I started when I developed Candyland when I was about 4 or 5, because I didn't want my sister to have to play this boring game. My, you know, toddler, infant sister. I didn't want her to play that drivel with told my mother how I was going to revamp it so it was more fun. But my mother, it was really her fault, because she was like, this sounds great. Let's do that instead. And so we played my homebrew of Candyland, House Rules. And that led to me writing more and more things. And I started playing D&D in the 4th grade. And then I started writing my own adventures for that, and my own RPG spinoffs for fun, just for fun. I had no idea that that could be a job you could do when you grew up. I just did it for funsies. And then was also in theater. So I did a lot of theater and went off doing that. And then I became a teacher. And while I was teaching, I designed hundreds of educational board games and then started a board game company. So basically I like to do creative pursuits that probably are never going to make me any money, but I have a lot of personal satisfaction.
I think that's great. Also, I love that it's a passion for you. I love that it leading to other things. And I think the world is better for better educational games. So thank you for doing all that work. But I cannot let you go any further without discussing the Candyland development. So you got to tell us how you developed it.
My mother, I'm fairly certain. I was like, my mother was like, what do you want to do today? Do you want to play a game? And I was like, I don't remember how it led to it, but I do remember being full of consternation that she had suggested Candyland and I didn't want to play it. And I never wanted Kate to play it. And I'm not sure why I fixated on my baby sister. I was, you know, think of the children. Won't you think of the children,
right,
as I'm,
yes,
4? And my mother's like, why? And I said, well, it's no fun. You don't get to do anything. The game just tells you what to do. And she's like, what do you mean? I said, well, I just pick a card and then I have to do what the card says. And that's not fair. And she said, well, what do you recommend? And I said, well, I said, draw two, pick one. I didn't say draw two, pick two. Through my childhood explanation, I said, I want choice. I want some level of strategy. And she's like, well, that seems reasonable.
Totally.
Okay. Reasonable. That's how we play now. And that was how we always played. And I remember going to a friend's house and being like, no, I don't know. No, I don't want to play it that way.
Why not?
Right. So, you know, nothing revolutionary, but when I was like four, that was kind of a big deal. And the fact that my parents were like, yeah, no, valid.
Yeah.
Was like, it made me very early realize that even though it was a published thing that was made, like, you think object permanence, and that's a big thing when you're little. And my parents taught me very early on that that didn't have to be the case with board games, which meant that every time we played a game, which of course sometimes my parents are like, okay, enough, Julie. We get it. You're precocious. Settle down. Yeah, when we would play games, I've always been thinking, how could this be better? Why is this interesting? How can I articulate what I like and don't like? I just didn't know that people got paid to do that.
Right.
And it was my fun, you know, and my family is much bigger on cards. We did a lot of family games, style games that, you know, all the classics that we can think of. And card games. And then we played a lot of card games, my family, from Euchre and Rummy and poker. We had massive poker tournaments in the summer when we were on vacation for quarters. And then all the quarters would get put back in the little quarter bin.
I love it.
So we played a lot of like that. And I found in fourth grade, D&D was a thing.
Mm.
And played all through middle school. I'm still friends with a lot of my D&D middle school group.
Love
We're
that.
Still friends.
That's great.
A little bit less in high school because I was doing a lot of theater, but still would occasionally play a game. And then back again in college, where actually just very recently I said I have both theater and D&D. So of course I started LARPing pretty much as soon as I could, because that's what you do. So it was a little bit until I actually got into board games. And then when I did, it was very interesting because I almost came from it the design point, because I had written a dissertation for my master's thesis for education saying, how do you get kids more involved who are not the multiple intelligence theory that came out of Harvard of, you know, we study and do a lot of testing for math and science and pattern recognition acumen, but there are other intelligences such as kinesthetic, interpersonal that are just as valid in use of everyday life, but aren't necessarily taught or tested in school. But if you at least educate using those approaches when you're doing math and science and all the things, that you will reach a wider range of your students. So my dissertation incorporated how you would use board games to reach all those other students. And I had principals read it, and I didn't know that that was going to be a thing that happened. But several principals, like apparently my dissertation, I think like the group that I was in, it's a concentration of, from William and Mary, there's a concentrated group that do an accelerated program for masters. And so I think the principals look at the people in that program very closely for new hires. Didn't know that. I just knew that it was accelerated and I could get through my master's program faster, which I guess, you know, is a weird approach. But apparently if that's something you're looking for, is to, you know, finish a program instead of like luxuriating in your college time.
Right.
That's also saying something. So yeah, a bunch of principals read it and several of them said they were basically wanted to hire me, but one of them specifically was like, I would like to hire you and I would immediately like you implementing this. I was like, what? They're like, yeah, we need you to make board games so that kids could do better in testing. I was like, sure.
Love that. Love that so much.
And I had my co-designer and co-teacher at the time Kate Maxlow is now an admin, and she's incorporated what we started those many, 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 many years ago in an entire district in Hampton City Roads, Virginia. So they do gamification at the elementary school level citywide. That is just the coolest thing.
Really is. I'm so jealous. I didn't have access to something like that growing up, and I would have loved that. And I don't think I've ever been jealous of a school district before, and now I kind of am. So that's kinda
I wish I had gone to school there. I mean, it is great. Like, even their testing is more like an RPG. So you're having an adventure, and then you come across a puzzle, but the puzzle is all like assessment of, and it's integrated knowledge of, so it's cross-referencing your reading and math and either science or social studies within like the assessment, and it's applying it to this narrative of an adventure you're going on. It's so good. So anyway, that's where I started. And then I, for fun, was playing board games on, you know, just for fun board games. And then had Jeff from Green Briar Games start a zombie game and say, what do you think? And of course, my what do you think was a little bit more feedback than he probably wanted. But
I'm guilty of those kind of things too. Yeah.
And that kind of started the whole, you know, that started the apocalypse, which was our first game back in 2011.
Awesome. Awesome.
And we're going to talk a lot more about the apocalypse here. Sure. Once we get to the dive. And so we can get to that, let's go ahead, and my instruments are starting to turn on. Let's go ahead and go to our pre-launch and talk about what games we played recently.
The pre-launch. Get to know us and our guest.
In the pre-launch, we talk about one game we played recently and what we thought about it. So there's no roses, thorns, and hula hoops here, Julie. Just one game. Sorry. Just one game. Let's go ahead and kick it off with Andrew. I want to hear about this one because I am excited about it.
Yeah, so I recently got a chance to play River Valley Glassworks, which, of course, is super adorable art. It's basically sea creatures / pond creatures collecting glass out of a river, and it's got a little river tableau right there. And so you're either putting glass in and then taking glass out and then putting it into your tableau, or you're retrieving it from the pond at the end of the stream, basically. And how this game really works, the really nuts and bolts of it, is that as the stuff you collect goes into your tableau, and everything you collect of the same type goes above it, and you go down your tableau that way. So you're trying to get the furthest you can down your tableau and then the highest up you can in the back end of your tableau, while still also creating a series of stacked stones that give different points the way you go. I think it's really clever, really cute, really elegant, and a quick game that has a crunch to it that's really kind of fun for being such a quick game. I think this is kind of on that Azul level of kind of like being easy to teach, yet still also having crunch to it. Highly recommend this one. I like it a lot.
That's Kids Table Board Gaming, right?
I have to double check that.
I thought that was All Play.
Was it All Play? All Play has some great stuff coming out.
God, they do. They're killing it.
This is Ben Pinchback and Matt Riddle, so I'm going to have to give this a look because I really like them as designers. They're the only role in White Cell Play is designed by them, so I'm excited to play anything by them.
And the components are really cool, too. The little pieces of frosted glass are so much fun.
Yeah, it looks so deluxe for all play games look great no matter what, but like they tend to be on the more affordable side, even their big box games. But this looks
great. They have the same. So they have the small and the medium. They're always the set same price, and they have for being set price. Yes, it feels almost like luxury. Like the components and everything. They do a lovely job. I have a ton of them. I don't have this one, but I have a ton of All Play games.
Yeah, I'm in that boat, sadly, where I actually do a ton of demoing for them at all the big conventions.
Mm-hmm.
Like I know Joe and Mark and all those guys. And so I don't have a lot of, I have like two or three of their games, but I played all of them multiple times. like I say, Basket Boss is one I love, but I demoed it for like 16 hours straight one weekend because they just need someone to do Basket Boss. Uh-huh. It's like I really don't want to play this game right for a very long time.
Have you seen their new one that will be coming out, Things and Rings?
Yeah, that's Peter Hayward's game.
Yeah,
it looks so good.
It is.
They're just really good at choosing games.
They are.
They really are.
They are.
So, yeah. Well, eventually we'll get Joe on this podcast. He's been on once before to talk about one of his Kickstarters, like Through the Desert. We'd love to get him on a podcast proper, but he's a very busy man. So,
fair enough.
What about you, Julie? What have you been playing recently?
So I played recently Expressions, which is a new game from a new publisher, Barnmaid Games. And it was a deduction game. So you have five suits in five colors, numbers 1 through 10. Okay. And everybody gets the majority of it. It's five rounds. So there's 50 cards. Five of the cards are face down in a pile. The rest of the cards have been passed out to the players. So in your hand, you have a number of cards, and you are trying to put them down in the, so that it's a super light on theme. They have so let's just say they have the good side and they have the good point side and the bad point side. And you're trying to get them on the good point side. And to do that, I have to say, you, Josh, have the red five. And if I'm right, you will put the red five down on the plus side. And I also get to just shed a card at that point. If I'm wrong, you're going to put it on the negative point side, and I also have to shed a point on the negative point side. But in order to do this, to help us out, to figure, deduce this, I have on each side of my card four different ways to put in hints. So I could say, this is the lowest I have of this color. This is the highest I have of this color. This is the last I have of this color. Or I have other numbers of this number.
Okay.
So I can put it face down. But so I can give that hint. But once I do, when it no longer applies to me, it goes into the bad point side. So you have to be careful about how many hints you're giving out.
So you're guaranteeing some negatives in order to give information out.
Give information. So I had almost all of the greens. And the highest, so it was like 10, 9, 8, were in already discarded. And you can see what's been, so as you go, as you play, you can see more numbers as they, because they're laid out in the tableau of good and bad points. So I had one, and I put, this is the lowest I have of this number. So anybody looking at the cards doesn't have any greens at this point. I know I'm the only one with greens. I have all the ones that are not already played, but I can't. It's, you know, so everybody looks down and they're like, and other people can talk about it, be like, well, she says she has the lowest, and you can't say I don't have any.
Right.
And this is out. So I think that probably means she has at least the two of greens. And I'm like, yes. And once I put the two out, I leave the one there because the rule still applies. So I could be like, yes, here's my two. And I'm leaving my one here. So that's, you know, like as you're playing. So it's this so simple, and yet it was just a great, like, four player brain burning. We played with the designer. He's of course amazing at it. So he could, there were plenty of times where he's like, you have the seven yellow. And so, and somebody else was like, how did you know that? He's like, can't tell you. there's plenty of like back and forth interaction, and it's super fun, super easy. Had a great time playing it, and that was at Dice Tower West, where they had a small booth.
Cool.
Yeah.
And you're just coming off of Dice Tower West. How'd that go, by the way?
Oh, it's always a blast. I love the Dice Tower shows, because I think every time I go to one, there's tons of people who are always just willing to like sit down and play games with you. This was the first time, because I just started being on the podcast, where people were like, oh, it's Julie. And that's a little surreal. So, you know, plenty of times that I've gone in the past where it was just like, I don't know, people are just very friendly and welcoming in my mind. And I just have a great time, and I get to play lots of games and talk to lots of people. And it's a good time. Demoed a lot of prototypes that I can't talk about. There, I'm all really excited about them. I got to, the one that I did talk about was, you know, All Play, who was there.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was super fun.
It's one of those ones I've always wanted to get out to. Either I can get out to West if I want to, because I have family who lives in southern Utah, And that gives me an excuse to see them as well, because Vegas is like a 2-hour drive from there. And then there's this Dice Tower East as well, which is only like a 6 or 7 hour drive from where I'm at in North Carolina. So I'm trying to figure out how to get to either one of them. It's just timing. It's always timing.
Fair enough.
Always.
So what did you play? Because I don't think we've talked about your game.
We have not. I want to keep this quick so we can get to your story. I played Wormholes from AEG, designed by Peter McPherson. Wormholes is a game where you are a bunch of ships trying to deliver passengers across the galaxy, and all the while you're creating little spots called wormholes that you can kind of pop through and jump across the map to different areas. You can also use other players' wormholes to try to get to other areas faster, but paying them victory points while you do it. That's pretty much the gist of the game. It's extremely simple place pick up and deliver mechanisms where you just get cards that are passengers and you try to take them to the planet that matches the card. There are some obstacles on the map that make it more difficult for you to get around and things like that, or shoot you in one direction faster if you want to. So I played this once over a gaming weekend at Mythicon in Asheville, North Carolina, and I gotta say I enjoyed it. We played it at 2 players. And at first I thought there wasn't much strategy to it. It's just place. That's just kind of the strategy. Where do I place my things on this map? But as I played, strategies begin to evolve, I guess, even though unravel in this game about when do you place your different wormholes. Because if you place them too quickly, other players won't have any need to place their wormholes out until later in the game. Because if you place your wormholes out later in the game, you're actually going to get more points for doing that as opposed to putting them out later. And if they're using your wormholes, yeah, you get 1 point, but they might get 2 points from their card or so on and so forth. And so placing them strategically where they are just maybe out of reach of your opponents, but still within your reach to do some chaining, turned out to be a very important strategy that I didn't see until very late in the game. And I enjoy games like that seem simple at first, but then as you look back, like, oh, wait, there is a little bit of strategy to this. I want to play again and try to re-implement it. And so great production, as always, from AEG. I am looking forward to playing this one again. This is one my wife really enjoyed. She really loved this game. It has modular boards, so nothing's going to be the same each game. But overall, that was Wormholes by AEG.
All right, 2 quick questions on that. One, how much luck-based was it? Because it seems like it's some luck, but now, the way you describe it, maybe less. So I want to hear that.
The only thing that's luck about this game is what passengers you get from the card draw.
Sure.
And you can kind of mitigate that through the teleportation. And there's a mechanism where that you can actually discard cards from your hand if you don't want them, and they're put on the station. And then you can just redraw them back up if you go to another station. So
you can mitigate the people through teleportation. Sounds like you're in one of the Star Trek episodes. And, you know, that's...
Yes, we can mitigate the... It does. It's very Star Trek-y, though. It is a very Star Trek-y game. You get that vibe a lot if the Enterprise was a passenger vessel. So, but yeah, that's Wormholes. Well, my instruments have been screwed into place with duct tape and silly putty, so we're ready to dive down deep into this tale we're about to hear. So, Julie, let's go ahead and dive into your story. Julie.
Yes.
Regale us with Tales of Yore.
Okay. Tales of Yore. Yes. So the question was, what was my most memorable tabletop game experience? Which was hard. It was actually a hard question because as you spend time in the tabletop industry, there are tons of great experiences and sometimes epically terrible ones that make great stories. So narrowing it down to just one is actually kind of a challenge sometimes. So I went with my earliest.
Okay.
So like I said, we had designed Zepocalypse, which was our first Greenbrier Games first game. We had just gotten it printed and sending things out to Kickstarter backers. And so we were on tour, which is how I thought about going to conventions back then.
Yeah.
We were going on tour. And I had been to PAX East. But for some reason, it just didn't resonate the same way that Gen Con did. Like, it's a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
but it's all video games. And so I just compartmentalized it. Well, that's not our industry. That's an industry adjacent, but it wasn't. And back then there really wasn't very much tabletop or board games at PAX East either. I think that's grown at the convention as well. So I had been to a bigger convention before, and I'd been to lots of the smaller ones in New England, but I hadn't been to the show. You know, I was still in AAA. So we didn't say we're going to go to Gen Con, and Ricky was our artist. He was in a band. He had been doing like music, and he was like, I want to go on tour. I was like, what does that mean? He's like, I'm going to sign us up to go to different retail stores, like board game stores, and play the game on the way to Gen Con. And Gen Con's like the big event. I was like, yeah, okay, I'm in. And because at the time I was still teaching, so I had the summer off, and I was like, yeah, I can do that. And everybody else was just going to fly to Indianapolis. So we do that, and it was ill-advised. I mean, people loved us, but we were just like, we would drive 2 hours, stop at a store, demo all day, crash somewhere. I think one of the times was in the car, drive 2 hours to the next, and got, you know, like 2 or 3 days, and got to like, did a morning and an afternoon at 2 different stores, and then got to Indianapolis. And then I taught the game from like 8 or 9 in the morning every day till 2 in the morning.
Oof.
And we had maybe 4 tables. Oof. For events. And I was running 2 at a time. Wow. Because I just, that's how I roll. I GM, I do a lot of, so like, I was like, I give good show when when I teach a game, I give good teach. So they were just like, Julie's got it. Julie's on it. And I was like, okay. And I was so, you know, I was like a squirrel on crack because I was so excited. It's our first game. So I agreed to all of this, and I did not set up any boundaries or, you know, barriers in place for basic health. don't be like me, kids. Make sure you actually eat food and sleep at Gen Con, right. Your first Gen Con. But I didn't. What? I was just all adrenaline.
Yeah.
I can't live off of Mountain Dew, you mean? Like, I just can't drink Mountain Dew and survive.
Correct. So we were in, like, the, you know, the events hall, which is, like, and it's gotten even bigger since then. But we were in, like, the, where you turn. So if anybody hasn't been, it's almost set up like a giant U between the vendor area and being like a reverse L, and then the other part of it being the events area at Gen Con in the convention hall, where so it's this massive space that's kind of broken up by an aisle outside in the middle. So we were in the corner of the top of view of the events area, so I didn't even see the vendor hall for days. And we're in this, like, in that one little corner, which felt relatively small by comparison, which actually felt, I think, safer, like, for somebody new to the big space.
Sure.
And all I did was get up, go to my table, set up my 2 games, and run, like, do an intro, come back and check and see if you were killed off by zombies yet, set up the next day, do it. I got very loopy. And so Saturday was, there were a couple different special moments, but there was, I'm going to give you just one.
No, yes. I want more just than one.
Okay, we'll take one. It'll give you a taste of what the whole day was like. So I get, you know, I had set them up, and they had done date. Like, there's, you have up to date four days in Z-pocalypse. And the idea is you're going to die in the zombie apocalypse. It's just how good are you, were you at living before you succumb to the winning team?
Okay. All right.
Is really how, and we set it up. It's very narrative rich. It's a lot of, you feel it, but you're running a squad of survivors. And as they die, maybe you find more people, maybe you don't, but when the last person's gone, you're done. Game's but over. How many points did you score? So in doing that, you get points for, you know, combat, you get points for crafting things, you get points for like a bunch of different stuff. Very campaign, narrative, dudes on a map, with a lot of extra storytelling. But I had done side quests because everybody loves a side quest in RPGs. And so I made a whole stack of side quests that you could do so that if you got the points of doing the side quests as well, you get bonus points for those, but also they're just fun extras. So some guy had gotten his, like, you could just, you automatically get one at the beginning of the game. You can choose to do it or not do it. And they were all very, they're written ludicrously because that's how we roll with the apocalypse. And, but like most people don't, like most people ignore them their first gameplay. They're just window dressing because it's an extra thing. This guy's like, this game is broken. I was like, do tell, please share. And he's like, well, this side quest, it's just dumb. There's no way you could ever do it. I don't remember all of the writing, but I do remember it started, you learned karate at the local Y and think you have some skills. So if you can kill six zombies with just your hands, which is rolling a six on a D6, your fists then get stats and you don't need weapons, which is super useful because you can have extra food and extra other stuff and not have to worry about holding your weapons because they are your fists. Sure. And yeah, it's dumb, but it's doable. And the guy was like, there's no way. And I was like, get up. And he's like, what? I was like, get up. You stand and watch. I'm going to do it. I'm taking your seat. And I'm doing it in one round. So it's going to take me, give me like 10 minutes. And he's like, no. I was like, yes or no. Either you are a liar or I am. And he was like, okay. And he got up. And I sat down. I went, cool. And combat has started. So I'm going to use my first action to move this many spaces over to these zombies. And then I'm going to kill them with my bare hands. And I did that every time. Every time I rolled. Every time I rolled. I would scream it that way. And I had no voice by the end of the weekend, of course. But like, this was not helping.
No.
And I did this for 10 minutes. And at the end of it, I had killed six zombies and I hadn't died and my fist said stats. And then I was like, I went to like turn and be like, and now you can take your seat back, sir. And there was a crowd of people watching and I had not even noticed. There was like 30 people because who is this? Like, I look like everybody's elementary school teacher and I'm like acting. Yes, that was a magical, magical moment playing Z-pocalypse that was forever ingrained because I scared myself after looking up and then there were all these humans watching me and I was like, no, people!
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I love stories. The stories like that are exactly why we started this podcast, because these are the kind of things I want to hear. And I think when you have that total immersion moment where you don't have any idea about what else is going on, that means you are living the game, which is the whole point of doing all this stuff anyway. That's awesome and amazing.
Yes.
But on top of that, I love the fact that somebody challenged you and said, oh, yeah, really? Hold my beer. I love that. That's great.
Just, well, I think the moral of the story is don't tell a designer that they can't do something in their own game.
Right. But I don't know if he knew that you actually designed that game or did he?
I introduced myself when I went to demo it.
All right. No excuse.
I am Julie. I co-designed this game. Buckle up. Here we go. We're on an adventure. Yes. There were lots of times. You can't do that. Yes, you can. No, the rule book doesn't say it. On page 17, paragraph 1B.
That's even more impressive because
I had edited the book over and over and over. I wrote it on. I knew where all the rules and all the most confusing rules where they were.
That's awesome.
Because they're the, you know, they're the ones that I understand that probably maybe it should have been developed more. Fair point, but they didn't because it's a sandboxy game. So yeah, sometimes it's going to be a little wiggly and I get it, but I also know where the rules are for them.
That's so cool. Cause one of my favorite moments was my wife playing Ticket to Ride Germany and Alan R. Moon comes walking up and they're like, oh, we have a question about the rule. He's like, I don't remember which version of this game it is. I can't tell you what the rules are.
Oh so. Yeah. I couldn't like now don't challenge me now. I couldn't remember now, but like after being fresh off of writing it, publishing it, working on the rule book, I was good. I was solid. And yes, there are plenty of times where somebody's like, no, you can't do that. No, you can.
Yeah.
I promise.
So in your opinion then, Julie, what makes an immersive game experience? How does a game conduit that for people?
Good question. It's a lot of just like, oh, so good. Cause that's like why theme matters. So it really does depend on the game and it really does depend on the experience. If you're going to be fully immersive, narrative super helps, art super helps, but also the gameplay has to reflect it. Mm-hmm. If you, and there are so many good examples, but the one I always go back to, Holding On, The Troubled Life of Billy Kerr, as one that either you buy into, you are a caregiver for somebody in the hospital who is been in a crash and you don't know who he is and you're not sure, like his life is very distressing to him. And so you're worrying about his emotional health, his mental health, and his physical health, but also getting burnt out. And you're putting mm-hmm. tokens on each of your little, they look like in Sorry, those kinds of token. Like, so you put a little ring and that's a stress, like, so adding stress that feels like it's around the, like, it's not an actual meeple, but it feels like it's around the neck. And like, mm-hmm. you just like, just that simple action of doing that and adding stress where somebody has to eventually just leave for the day to take time because the burden of caregiving has caused too much strain for them. Like little things like that, that you can do it in mechanics, you can do it in narrative, but the more cohesive it is, the less you have of a, well, this took me out of the game and now I have to get back into it, is what creates an immersive experience. So there's lots of ways to do it. It's what kind of experience are you looking for? And that's playtesting too. I mean, that's, you gotta have actual other people play it. You can't just do it in the vacuum.
I love that point. And I will put a fine tune on it, as I think anything that keeps you into the game and not pulling you out is part of what makes it immersive, right? So anything you can add in that makes it natural or don't have to look at the rules because it's intuitive, like all those things absolutely bring you in because we as people really want to be brought in. We want to be so immersed in this game that we are totally involved. So really it's up to you as a designer to stop us from not feeling that. That's what it's really about.
Right. And there's also, I mean, so is it immersive in the dumb, stupid, funny? Mm-hmm. Great. Lean in, whatever it is that you're doing. Like, is it because it's tense and scary? Lean in. Nyctophobia, lean in.
Yeah, right.
Like, it just depends.
But whatever do that well. Yeah.
Well, for designers, then how do they find that? Because some people, especially me myself as a designer, they really struggle to find that angle through playtesting, like what their game, where their game should go in order to increase immersion. So you being experienced in that, how would you recommend finding that for designers?
Okay. So you have an idea in your head and somebody, yes, who has done this plenty of times. It's brilliant in your head. It's amazing. It is just
right.
Surround sound, like, you're there and then you play it and it's more plenty of times. So many times it's happened to me. You don't go, well, this is just terrible. It's over. Flip the table, walk away. You go, okay, but where were the moments? Cause there's still going to be moments of it. You'll find that. What was that? What was it I did? Was it something physical? Was it something mental? What was it that caused that frisson of excitement or joy or laughter or frustration in the good way of delayed gratification that you want. What was it that physically and action-wise I did and that caused, that got that? How do I do more of it?
Yep.
Do I do it this way? Do I do it this way? And then the more you do it, the more you start knowing the mechanics, rule sets that kind of lean into it. So that's how you start. And then you get it to a point where you're pretty satisfied with just in general and you know it's fine tuning. And then you find somebody else to break your rule book.
Yep.
Because you're going to, but I do, I edit other people's rule books and then I always have to hand my rule book to somebody else because there is always, always, always something that was in my head that doesn't make it to the page because it's so intuitive in my brain at that point from playing it so many times that I don't think to write it down. I think it goes without saying. It doesn't. It never goes without saying. And then somebody finds it and goes, but Julie, when do I move the purple thing? Because the purple thing is really important. And I go, yeah, it's super important. You do this. And they're like, but it didn't say it anywhere in the rule book. And I'm like, you don't get to say, well, that goes without saying. You don't. It's a rule. It goes in the rule book. So you have to find people who either love you very, very much, are willing to trade for other services or pay them to do this, which also means I do a lot of this for other people. I do a lot of here, give me your toy and I'll give you my toy and we will, you know, be kind to each other when we break it.
Yeah, I think that's huge. Just bringing someone else in, a second pair of eyes, proofreading, whatever. And we all have different skill sets, right? So someone who's really terrible at writing rule books like myself, I know I absolutely have to hand that off to somebody else to take a look at it because I'm not going to be as good as somebody who's better at that. Mm-hmm. But I also can offer something else I'm better at to somebody else. And so I love this whole sharing and being collaborative and even just letting other people touch your stuff. Don't be too precious. Don't hold it in and hoard it and then hope it makes it out in the real world and survives, because it won't.
Right. And to that end, I have people who are all over the map on their feels about this. I prefer people write down their feedback. I prefer writing down your feedback before talking about it. So if I'm doing it in person, I'm asking them to fill out a form, a piece of paper, and I keep it short. It's like one piece page. If you want to flip it over and add more information on the back, more power to you. But like, I want that initial before they can share and have a collective experience where then suddenly I'm getting whoever's the strongest personality's feedback echoed to me four times. But also because if they say not nice things about my design, I can wait until they're not there to get mad at a piece of paper who isn't going That's to good. Look at my face. And then either feel bad or have Schadenfreude. Right. Yes, you can't like, and also because you're going to do what you want to do. Like in your design, you have to do what's right for you. Mm-hmm. But with the caveat, if you're doing what's right for you and you're trying to actually get it to market, what's right for you has to be what's right for the majority of human beings who are going to be playing this game.
100% agree.
So if you're just doing it for your own personal satisfaction and and maybe it does well in market and maybe it doesn't, fine. But plan for it to never make you money and to probably lose money in the endeavor, in the pursuit of your own personal joy and satisfaction, which is fine. That's how people buy cars or go shopping for shoes. There's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. But if you're going to do it to try to make it something that is a product for sale, you cannot just treat it as art. You have to treat it as a product, in which case you actually have to listen to what the majority of people in the feedback are saying, whether you like to hear it or not. And I do better yelling at paper about that than I do showing my face to people in person when I'm unhappy with the news I'm receiving. So that's my personal preference. But again, other people, different ways. But I also find it's fascinating when I do give feedback and somebody starts trying to argue with me about the feedback I'm giving. Because I always start with, are you looking for feedback when I play somebody else's game? If it's just off the cuff. Now, when they say yes, then it's on them. Because feedback, I'm going to give you what I liked and I'm going to give you what I didn't care for and why I didn't care for it. I'm going to make it constructive. But there's plenty of people who don't actually want the feedback. I've learned
that's their fault because the game is never good enough, period. Right. Not even when it's published. Right. Lots of designers wish they could take back published games and say, I would fix this or I would tweak that or I would make this adjustment.
I think we do that regardless. Frosthaven after Gloomhaven. Isaac Childress is like, no, I can do that better. Like that's
yeah, of course.
Like everybody's gonna feel that way about. So it's not so much that as in the moment. If you're not good at receiving feedback, find another way to get the feedback.
Agreed.
If it's not just in the moment, it's just always, and you just want to do what you want, then that just know that you're making art. You're not, and not art, like, and I'm not trying to say it as a derogatory kind of way about art either. I'm saying you're making something that's unique and special for yourself.
Yes.
That has no bearing on what the general public is going to judge it as. And you're not making a marketable product or a sellable retail product
for yourself.
Right. Yeah,
you're making dinner for yourself, not a restaurant dish.
Correct.
Well, this has been an awesome conversation. We don't want to keep Julie down here too long. We try to keep this to be nice and tight. Fair but there's enough. Lots of – we have the heads of Designers Past who cannot take feedback floating next to us. Let's go ahead and turn on our sonar and see what we've been playing in the future. On the sonar, we talk about one game we look forward to playing in the future and why we're looking forward to playing it. I'm going to throw this right back to you, Andrew, and tell me, what are you looking forward to playing?
So there's a game on Board Game Arena that I had never heard of called The Veil of Eternity. They were kind of hyping it up and whatever not. It was in promotional time period, and it seems so interesting. Basically, it seems like you are collecting these creatures and then training them or summoning them or trading them in for jewels or something like that. So it's like this hand management Pokemon-style hunting kind of thing going on. It just seems really interesting with some cool art. And so I'm looking forward to checking that one out, but I don't really know what I'm getting into. So it could be cool.
This is one that Patrick and Scott from Level Up played, and they say they very much enjoyed it, especially on Board Game Arena. Very cool. Combo-tastic. They said, and this is one I've been meaning to try. I almost bought it recently, actually, but I didn't. I instead bought a little My Neighbor Totoro Othello set that I found, which was totally worth it, to be completely honest.
Legit. Nice.
What about you, Julie?
So I acquired the White Castle.
Nice.
At Essen, and I have yet to play it, and I've been looking forward to it. So that's Devere. There's very little that Devere puts out that I'm unhappy with. So I'm usually pretty excited to play whatever they've got. Mm-hmm. And I've heard good things. It's just one that I haven't gotten to the table. And I have made specific plans to play it mid-April with specific people who are going to learn it and do the teach so that I have no choice but to play it.
Nice. Love it.
That I'm excited for because, of course, I was just a Dice Tower, like we said, and I have to pick my binge game playing times. So that is the one that I'm most excited to play next. That is some meat to it. That's going to take some time and thought and crunch while playing.
Yeah. Devere's been putting out lots of these really great, like affordable Euros.
Yep.
Like they've been doing Three Ring Circus, yep. White Castle, Bamboo, and they all look fantastic. Really, and I've yet to play a single one of them. Just because I just haven't been able to get to it. But Bamboo, especially for me, looks fascinating. But I've been hearing nothing but great things about the White Castle. Plus, I'm one of the crazy people out there who actually enjoys White Castle burgers. So I'm very much...
Oh, see, I'm coming up from it. The White Castle is the palace when it was in Kyoto, where the emperor was before the capital of Japan moved to Tokyo. And I've been there because I went to Kyoto Nishi High School when I was in high school.
That's awesome.
They're very different life experiences. <with you. laughs>
And I think I've only been to White Castle, like two times. So
When I go to Columbus, I make it a point to do two things, is to visit a White Castle and get my greasy sliders. And then the other one is to like try to get some, let's go to North Market and get some pierogi. But that's neither here
Those
nor
are
there.
Solid endeavors.
It's very solid. No, not sign a game or advance my career. It's those two things. That's what it's for.
I'm all about Jenny's when we're in Columbus. So yeah, I'm there.
Yes. Fair enough. Well, for me to finish this off, I am looking forward to playing Fractal. Fractal is a giant 4X game that has recently come out by Boar Games Studios, like Pig. And my friends at the Level Up Board Game Podcast, Patrick and Scott, I am meeting up with them to represent the Tabletop Swimming Podcast at Funkytown in Knoxville, Tennessee. And I am a huge fan of like games like Twilight, Imperium, and Eclipse. I like those kind of big 4X. Even though I'm more of a small gamer, I like those big ones when I can play them. And he is learning to play Fractal, and he is going to teach it so that we can all play it, and then hopefully they'll be able to review it on their show. But it just looks interesting. Like, I love giving these kind of big spacey games a try because you never know, you might find something that is just, you know, your cup of tea.
Right.
And this might be, and since I don't like tea too much, it may be my cup of soda or something like that. I'm looking forward to it. It's big, it's space, the art looks great, and I get to play it with friends. But that's going to be end of April, but that is Fractal from Boar Game Studios. Well, we've been down here for a very long time. Julie's a very busy person. We're going to shoot right back up to the surface, ignoring bends and all safety measures, so she can get up to the shore and get on her way. So let's go.
Ignoring safety measures are how good stories get told.
And we're here. Welcome back to the Land of the Living. Julie, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day and for just coming off of the Dice Tower West to sit with us here, talk about stories, listen to your wisdom. If people want more Julie Ahern in their life, what can they do?
Well, they can listen to the At the Table with the Dice Tower podcast, if they're podcast people, which I would assume, since they're here, they are. But then other than that, I'm over at Van Ryder Games. We've got the Graphic Novel Adventures Season 5 coming out March 19th on Kickstarter. So, you know, please go take a look there. And, of course, Final Girl.
Yeah, so some of you may be sad that we didn't talk more about Final Girl. But the reason we didn't do that is because we were asked not to, because there's a lot of things cool coming out that Julie said, and we're going to keep a lid on that. But just to let you guys know, if you haven't gotten to Final Girl or Hostage Negotiator, my personal preference, definitely do that. Well, as always, listeners, thank you so much for giving some of your time. If you like us, give us some ratings on Spotify or iTunes. Obligatory. Please help us grow this podcast. We want to continue to have great guests like Julian. And the more you share and the more you tell people about us, the more we are able to do that. The more people will take us seriously. You know, that's just how it goes. But as always, my name is Josh.
I'm Andrew.
And I'm Julie.
And this has been the Tabletop Submarine.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to support the Tabletop Submarine podcast, please consider giving us 5 stars on iTunes and share this podcast with your friends, family, and other gamers in your life. See you on the next voyage.